Hello, and welcome back to Slate Money Travel, the bonus mini-series from Slate Money. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, talking all about the business of the travel industry. And this week we have Colin Nagy, who is a man of many talents. Colin, what's like, do a quick list of who you are, because you seem to, you wear many hats and you're quite good at all of them.
Yeah, I run strategy for a ad agency called Fred and Farid, and we're Paris, New York, Shanghai, and Los Angeles.
So you travel to all those places?
Yeah, and I also write a hospitality column for Skift, and I, you know, very interested in hospitality, guest experience, and the idea that hospitality is a creative act.
So we are going to be talking all about exactly that, and specifically, this is we're going to translate this term hospitality, which is an industry term. What we are talking about is hotels, and we are going to talk about what makes a good hotel, why people pay extra to stay in a good hotel, and what builds loyalty, and all manner of other super gnarly interesting things, even the texture of the couch in the lobby. This is we're gonna get super detailed
with,
here
with good ghosts as
with
well.
Good ghosts. We're gonna talk about ghosts here on Slate Money Travel. Talk to me about ghosts.
Ghosts create the intangible magic of a place sometimes, and it could be a location, a la, I think Chamonix is a place that has good ghosts.
Good ghosts.
It has the ghosts of people trying to do something difficult in terms of mountaineering or blah, blah, blah. But when you go to that place, you feel something beyond the space, right? And then ghosts in terms of a particular location, you and I were just talking about how you could have the most magically designed perfect hotel or room, but like there are the intangibles that actually make or break a place. And it comes down to not just ghosts in a literal sense, but some deeper subconscious feeling that you get out of the space. And I think that that's what makes a hotel really addictive to people. You know what I mean?
So, Colin, you stay in many hotels.
Yes.
And you are kind of a hotelologist. You have like a column which writes regularly about hotels. And you are going to have a podcast about where you talk to hotel general managers?
Yeah, so I've been writing a hospitality column for 3 years, and a lot of it is kind of dissecting the nuances and the magic that goes into creating really interesting experience for someone. And that might come from the design of a space. It might come from how the, you know, staff interacts with guests, things like that. And because of all these conversations I've been having for several years, I've wanted to do, you know, longer form things. So I have, you know, 4 or 5 in the can, and I'm just going to be rolling it out pretty soon. But it's going to be longer conversations with GMs, really interesting hospitality thinkers, stuff like that.
Cool.
So, yeah.
So
watch this space.
So, yeah, we will definitely hang out and wait for that. But in the meantime, you can give us a little sneak peek of what you've learned. And the thing which the main thing which I just want to understand here is I am traveling to a certain place. I need a place to stay for the night. And there's a certain amount of convenience involved in staying in one location rather than in a less convenient location. So obviously I'm willing to pay for location. So my question is, above and beyond just that, like, you know, the shelter and the location, what goes into the price of a hotel room, and what can a hotel do that's going to make me like willing and even possibly eager to pay more so that I can stay in their hotel rather than someone else's?
Sure. I think a lot of it is context, right? I think we all have the situation where we just need a bed and a shower, right? And we're leaving at 6:30 the next morning and blah, blah, blah. But as all these hotels, as the space is getting more competitive, as you know, the monster brands develop more brands and the boutiques, you know, try to retain their interesting, you know, niche, I think it really comes down to, say, design How do you make something unique, comfortable, inspiring? But also, I think that a lot of it is the interactions with staff. And when you stay at a truly exceptional hotel, when you stay at the Park Hyatt Tokyo, it's almost as if it's everything runs as a Swiss watch. You know, the arrival, the way things just kind of magically happen for you, the greeting, the kind of moving into this, into a check-in, and everything is just so meticulously polished that you almost feel like you're a head of state, even if you're just some like person that used Hyatt points. And I think that that is the intangible of a great hotel, is to make you feel welcome, to kind of sand down any of the friction points, and to have this empathy, anticipation, and attention to detail. And I think that the hotels that do that the best, that welcome you almost like a friend rather than a transaction, are the ones that create what I think is actual loyalty.
So it's fascinating you picked out the Park Hyatt Tokyo, because that, of course, is the hotel from Lost in Translation. And that movie was mostly set inside the Park Hyatt Tokyo and portrayed the hotel as this kind of empty, soulless, vacuum-sealed bubble where the real world barely impinges.
It's actually the opposite of that. It's this place that I think is representative of hospitality in its like highest form, because you have a beautifully designed space, which is, you know, John Morford designed back almost 25 years ago. Then you have Japanese hospitality, you know, operating at the highest levels, and then you have the sort of how Japanese traditional hospitality is interacting with like a Western operating system. And the thing is as time has passed, the hotel has kind of developed this patina, has developed this, you know, feeling that is really special. And I think it's like the aggregation of all those moments over time, you know, makes it interesting. But it was used as a device in the movie.
Was like the movie version of the hotel maybe how it felt in the early days, and now it's kind of got a few layers of years on it?
I think the reason why Sofia Coppola used it is it was like one of her favorite hotels, but what she was using it as a device to almost kind of show like jet lag, being disoriented, being kind of removed in an alternate time zone in this sort of like liminal state. So right. She almost used the hotel as a device to tell that. But when you look more closely, there are like little subtle love letters to the hotel, like threaded out through the film, that kind of show me that she has a great affinity there. And when you actually talk to, she's one of their like longtime like treasured guests. So it was used as a device to kind of show this liminal state, but I don't think it was an alluding, you know, to anything negative.
Do you think that there's something universal about the appeal of the Park Hyatt Tokyo, that like you love it, Sofia Coppola loves it, would just about anyone staying there love it, or is there an actual genuine range of the kind of hotels that some people like and some people hate?
You know, I think that there's a range. You know, I think people that have a meticulous attention to detail and like the lines and almost like the math of that place, and also how everything is like just so precise all the time, it probably appeals to them. Whereas there's other hotels that are like the flip side.
I'm thinking
of
like
that.
If we're going to stay in movies here, something like the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is kind of crazy and ramshackle and goes off in all directions.
I think some people like the whimsy, or like being part of a, you know, something from a film or something out of that's a little strange. But I think if I recall, you like the San Jose or some of the Liz Lambert hotels in Austin. I think we were talking about that.
I like the grand hotels from 100 years ago,
okay,
which are a little bit shabby, but still show they're full of what you call ghosts. And I like the ghosts.
Yeah. And I think that some of the raffles, these grand old hotels. What's interesting to me about them is they don't make any concessions to modernity. Like I was, I think I was at a Raffles in Siem Reap in Cambodia, and it was almost as if I could look around and be in completely another time. You know, there was not iPads anywhere. Like all of the furniture was elegant. They were still doing things in a very analog way. And I thought it was quite comforting, right? So I think some of the grand hotels in that regard are amazing because they know what their brand is and they don't make like petty concessions to modernity.
They also just tend to have much larger physical footprints. They're often just sited on like these 5 or 6 acre sites. I'm thinking, you know, like the El Camino in Mexico City or something like that. Like you could never buy that kind of a plot right now. And there's a feel of luxury.
Like the Savoy, you know, in London.
Savoy in London,
you know,
right, yeah. Exactly. When you're in a hotel and it's always got a name like the Grand or the Excelsior or something like that. And it really is just,
The Kempinski in Munich, you know, where a lot of the DLD stuff is happening. It's like out of central casting for like a resplendent palace hotel, you know?
Exactly. You want to
Bayerischer Hof, right? Yeah.
Or any of those. They're very big. And so I guess coming back to my original question, like they can feel like you're going back in time. They give you this experience. How does that translate into like whether it's that or whether it's like a very modern hotel at the top of a high rise like the Park Hyatt Tokyo? How does that translate into me as a customer being willing and possibly even eager to pay thousands of extra dollars to stay there rather than to stay in some, you know, random place with a shower?
I think when you look at it as theater and not just a transaction or a place to sleep, then that kind of opens the door, right? You're stepping into a stage set that almost changes every day, right? I always joke about the lobby of a really great hotel and maybe a lot of the ones that you're talking about, the grand hotels. It's a coral reef that like refreshes with interesting new fish every day, you know? So you feel like you're part of something that's a little bit larger. You feel like you're in a kind of theatrical production. There's a little bit of romance and ambition that when done well, perhaps could command a little bit more of a price point. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that are obsessed with the Chateau in LA, and the reality is like some of the rooms at the Chateau are no great shakes, but you're paying for the romance, you're paying for the history, you're paying for the rock and roll, you're paying for the patina, and also the fact that you look around and it's pretty A-list. So I do think that you're alluding to the soft diplomacy of a place, or the kind of what are the feelings that you get out of a place that would actually inspire you to potentially pay up or stay there as opposed to a, you know, bed or a pod hotel or something.
So let me bring this down like maybe two notches.
Yeah.
I think on one level, it's quite easy to understand what's going on at the super high end of the luxury market and say, this is the best hotel in the world. And you get this main, incredible personalized experience. And they remember you from when you were last there 15 years ago and like what color your toenails are. But when you move away from that and you're just, you know, visiting some city and you're like, should I pay $200 a night or should I pay an extra $50 and pay $250 a night for this slightly better hotel? Like, what is it that makes the hotel slightly better and what makes me cool with that extra $50?
I feel like I'll root it in something that you know. In Munich, where you attend and speak at DLD pretty frequently, there's a lot of good sort of solid like Germanic hotels, right? You're just, I can go to this hotel. I know it's going to be okay. Then probably for that $50 more, you have the Cortina, which is a small boutique. There's an incredible bar. There's a fireplace. There's staff that care 25 to 27% more about what they're doing.
They do make extremely good cocktails in that hotel.
And it feels like when you go there, it feels a little bit more intimate. You're not rolling in with your luggage into this austere sort of, you know, arrivals area. It feels like you're almost coming back to someone's house.
Right.
And that cozy feeling that they have, particularly in freezing cold January in Munich, is kind of the feeling that you're talking about.
And I totally agree with that as well. And I would add like the Tabard Inn in Washington being another great example of this. And these are unique hotels where people go, oh, I really love that hotel and I'm willing to pay a little bit more. Or sometimes not even pay more. Sometimes they're cheaper and you just get to stay there. But just to make this a little bit harder for you, you know, we're talking about the mega brands which own like a gazillion different brands in different cities. Like, if you're not staying at something unique and special and boutique-y, but you are choosing between two different brands and one of them is $50 more, then what makes it worth it? Or is it not?
I think we're getting into a much more abstract conversation at that level. But what I can tell you is that the big chains are very interested in solving this, and they're solving it from like design. They're trying to solve it from reinventing how their common areas and spaces go from day to night, right? Like, how do you create a place that feels not as annoying as the Ace does, where you can't find a seat, but how do you sit in a place that actually feels like it has that nice bustle to it? If I'm taking a meeting or working on some work, how do I have you know, that nice, almost like coffee house murmur that is inspiring? You know,
because hotels were the original third places, right? Mm-hmm. Before the rise of Starbucks, they were this place which wasn't home and wasn't work, but where people could meet and transact. And this is, in a weird way, the commodity that like WeWork is selling as well. Yeah. There's like what you find in WeWorks is lobbies. They're one big hotel lobby. And then off in the corner, you get these tiny little, I guess, the equivalent of hotel rooms, which is kind of shabby.
It's a really good point. To answer your question more directly instead of tap dance around it as I have been doing, I think that with the bigger brands, this is a design brief, right? How do we make the design feel like not just guests, but the community want to come, want to linger, spend money, because food and beverage is also important, right? Especially from non-guests. And how does it feel like something akin to, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but what you're alluding to with WeWork, where it feels like there's a bustle going on and there's people together, because we're animals, right? We like being around other people. We like being around these kind of subconsciously comforting scenarios. And I think that third place vibe, when executed well, is also something that makes someone feel nice about a hotel. But the bigger point here is, a lot of our attraction to these spaces, they're not conscious things. Sometimes these are subconscious things. The smell of a lobby when you come in, you know, I love the Langham in London has a beautiful scent that's like ginger and a few things, and it's familiar and it reminds you of where you are, down to the feeling of, you know, the texture of the couch you're sitting on. There's very like subconscious things that are like the flow and energy of a space. And those are the things oftentimes that are actually like the ball game when it comes to, do I want to spend an extra $50?
Okay. So now, on which note, I think we're going to come back and look at this at a slightly different angle, which is like, how do you turn this into a brand?
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So we can all, well, those of us who've, you know, of a certain age who've stayed in a certain number of hotels, there are certain hotels we can remember and you can say, oh, yes, there's the smell of the lobby in the Langham, or there's the, you know, pool boy at the Copacabana Palace in Rio, or whatever it was.
The smell of the copper tone, you know.
But then in reality, when you're looking at the hotel industry, there's a bunch of just very large brands. It could be like the ones we all know and hate. It could be like the Sheratons and the Marriotts and the Hyatts and the Hiltons. Or it could be like the newer brands, which they keep on spinning off. But the whole point about these brands is that they carry with them the promise that what you experience at one of them is something which you can expect to experience at another. And so is there any way in which it makes sense to kind of say, oh, I really love the Park Hyatt Tokyo. It's an incredibly good hotel. So therefore, the Park Hyatt, you know, in Riyadh is going to be awesome as well.
So there's a few points to this question. Number one, I think that the consistency across a known brand is important to people. A lot of people like Airbnb and they're staying there. But what these hotels are selling in many ways is like predictability. In terms of, I know that the water pressure is going to be good. I know the internet's going to be good. I know that I'm not going to be entering in a dark alley in an unfamiliar neighborhood. So that sort of consistency across a brand, regardless of the price tier, is important. But I think the challenge here is there's too many brands, and there's too many brands that are competing for almost like the same territories. And thus, that's what's confusing to the marketplace right now. But backing up, the average consumer, the average buyer of a hotel is not like me. I'm not, you know, they're not obsessing at the level that I am because this is something that's very interesting to me. They're interacting with a brand with a number, a price, and a little tile that comes up on booking.com, right?
Right.
So the notion of brand is not as relevant as a lot of people think it is, because the OTAs, which, you know, for those not in the weeds of hospitality, you know, the aggregators of, you know, booking.com, Expedia, stuff like that, I'm going to Rio on these dates, and with this criteria, I will have something presented to me. And so this is the danger, in the same way that it's a danger for a brand, you know, on Amazon to be reduced to tissues, right? Kleenex was a brand for a reason, because it was like, this is how we differentiate ourselves. But when I say, Alexa, order me tissues, it's like, you know, the brand is eroded because of the algorithm and because of like the process. Same goes for hotels. So there's probably an argument to be made that, you know, brand and sensibility is like even more important today to actually stand out in the morass and not get reduced to just a number and a review and a little thumbnail image of a property, right?
But for most people, that is exactly what you are going to be for
exactly.
Most hotels.
Yeah.
And even the fancy hotels at some level are just going to be a number and a thumbnail.
I think the fancy hotels in many ways are being booked for people through a very trusted travel agent, you know, a high-end, you know, broker, you know, the Scott Dunns, the Abercrombie and Kents, the kind of old school travel advisor. And a lot of the business of these big hotels is catering to the clientele that has stayed there for 30 years, right? You know, there's people at the Connaught or the Claridge's that have been staying there for generations. And like, it's up to that hotel to, you know, maintain these portfolios of people that they know are going to come and spend the money.
So if I'm not a dynast, if I'm not someone who like has been going to Claridge's for generations, do you think that normal people just like, let's say that I go to a certain place on holiday, you know, every year, like there's something about getting into the familiarity of going back to the same place and knowing what to expect, that you can find that kind of comfort at much lower price points with much less personal touch, even when the person at the front desk probably has no idea who you are.
And I think what you're getting into is also just the role of loyalty and points with a lot of this.
And so where does loyalty come in? Do you think that people are in any way loyal to actual hotel brands, or is it just the loyalty plans and the points? And
I would
kind of
say
stuff?
That in many ways it's the program, and then based on that program, it's like what is the best possible thing that I can get given where I want to go. You know, so right. If I'm, you know, it's no longer SPG,
it's
you know,
Bonvoy.
It's Bonvoy. But I think that if you have a cache of points on there and you're looking to go skiing in the wintertime, you're like, okay, well, I'll see if I can get the St. Regis. And it's like, hopefully you can. But I think that the loyalty is what is the best possible experience in terms of the tier that I can get for my money or points. So I think that sometimes the loyalty to a program almost subsumes the loyalty to a specific brand.
Right. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you was, if you are a pure business traveler, you are on the road, you're like a banker, you're a lawyer, you're high end, it's all being paid, you're flying business class, you have a lot of money and it's not even your own money and your client is paying for it and it doesn't matter, but you always wind up, in my mind's eye, like these people always wind up staying in completely sort of bland yet expensive anonymous high-end hotels. Is that for a reason?
It really just depends. I think what you're alluding to is the corporate contracts that are negotiated with, you know, you see JP Morgan has a deal at the Peninsula Tokyo or something like that. You have the big companies that are doing tens of millions of dollars with American Airlines also have negotiated rates with some of these things. But, you know, sometimes there is a role for the luxury chains, for like the high-end business travelers. I mean, I know a lot of lobbyists and consultants that basically have like lived in a Four Seasons in Saudi Arabia or in the Middle East for like long extended periods of time. And it isn't like an airless thing. It's actually like they're treated very well for an extended period away from home, down to the even getting more personalized levels of service and more things that you probably wouldn't get as a normal guest. So there is a role for that predictable global chain for people that are always away from home.
And I have to say, and this is something back in the day when I used to go to Latin America for Euromoney, if I was having difficulty finding a hotel, every so often I would do this thing where I would ask someone at JP Morgan to just book me a hotel room. And I would pay for it, but it would be the JP Morgan rate, and I would be paying like $99 for the Four Seasons. I'm like, how on earth do they manage this?
And I think what they're getting is they have quotas in terms of how much business they need to send to the hotel. So it's actually not a problem if they're doing it ostensibly for a business partner or a reason like that. But yeah, it is the volume. It's a volume game, and I do think that it is astounding, not to dime out too many of these brands, but what rack rate is relative to what someone from a global corporation is paying. And it's the same thing with airlines. You can look at someone that's paying $8,000 for a seat to fly to London from New York, and then you can look at someone that's paying $1,500 or less because of these same things.
So when people tell me that they're spending, you know, 50 or 100 nights a year out on the road staying in these incredible hotels, and I'm just sort of mentally adding up like, oh my God, how much does that cost? It doesn't actually cost nearly as much as I probably think it does.
Yeah, I think it's probably there's a corporate rate or a mates rate going on, or they just don't care. You know, there is an echelon of, you know, this. There's a great documentary called Inside Claridge's, and there's a scene where Thomas, who's the unflappable GM, who's now at the Corinthia, you know, it's like, oh, the Saudis are coming unannounced and they need this and this and this. And they're like, oh, of course, no problem. And the ask is quite significant. You know, it's like, we need to remove this wall, and they only like the, and they're like, oh, of course, this is what we do. You know, so at that type of price point, it's also very good margins, good business for the hotel, even though it comes with a lot of difficult things to do and achieve. But that's what they're in the business of. And that's relating back to the beginning of our conversation, like that staff, that attention to detail, that unflappable, you know, classic hotelier is, when you experience it and you see it, that is the thing that maybe will make you pay more. Yeah.
Also, just the idea that I can rock up and they'll be like, yes, we have a room for you, which is like not the experience of any normal person, where you rock up and they're like, we don't have a room. We're sold out. You're never sold out if you're like the right person, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that perhaps if you're in San Francisco during Salesforce or something like that, then you might be sleeping on the street. But there are kind of ways around that, yes.
Okay. So to wrap this up, what is the number one way to find a hotel room in a place where it seems to be incredibly hard to find a hotel room? It's not just like Google hasn't worked. Now what do I do?
You know, I think that there is a, with the amount of, you could do some due diligence. You could send a couple emails. You can find the GM of a property. You can send a personal email. And I think that if you're showing interest in a property, if you're showing that you're not like the average, you know, person buying something on booking.com, it's funny when you appeal to the elegance and hospitality that is like inherent in a lot of these people, that magic can happen. And sometimes it could even just be like the right sentence. I mean, I encourage people to do this when they're going on a trip with a loved one. It's like, send the GM a polite note, just letting them know the occasion, you know, not asking for anything. And the inherent elegance of this profession will kind of come forward and like make something nice happen for you. The same thing can be said if you're in a pinch. It's like the polite email or the polite phone call to one of these men or women that are ostensibly in this business to take care of other people. Some doors can unlock for you. And then your idea from before of like appealing to the business community or the people that have relationships with the hotel or send them lots of business, that's probably also a decent way in, you know.
Colin Nagy, thank you very much for uncovering the secrets. You are off literally on a helicopter.
I'm just trying it out. Just because Blade had a decent deal, so I'm gonna take that today.
You're gonna take a Blade helicopter from where to where?
5 minutes from the west side to Kennedy, and it's on a Friday evening. It would normally be a hour and a half, 2 hours. You know?
Okay, and then
and
where?
Actually, to be perfectly honest, you know, this is really only, I would say, $60 more than I would be paying for an Uber. So I'm not living the life of luxury here. I'm just trying to be pragmatic with my time.
You're being a pragmatic helicopter passenger.
I could get screwed if the weather, you know, if the weather falls
apart. And
you're
off to what, to Paris?
No, I'm just headed to the West Coast just for a couple of days. So.
And you're going to stay somewhere fabulous?
I'm staying with a friend, actually, because
I approve of staying with friends. It keeps you grounded.
What I actually love about that is I stay at so many hotels that, you know, when I go see my friend Will in L.A., he's so gracious, and I stay with him, and it's like a completely different experience. It's so fun, you know, and it's nice. As much as I love hotels, when I have friends I want to catch up with, it's very nice to be hosted and to, you know, do something nice and get together.
Have a fun time in LA, and thanks for coming on to Slate Money Travel.
Thank you, Felix.